Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You will be listening to this show in one of two ways. Either you are at the blog, which is lordgaul.podbean.com. Lord Gaul was my username when I first got into the sport, back when K1 USA was big, in Kakatugi and K1 fans and so on. And also, the most efficient way to get my show, to get your regular kickboxing and Muay Thai updates, is just to enter Warman Kickfighting Show into the iTunes search engine, and the show pops right up. I got a big show today. I'm pretty excited because I got a guest who, it's so crazy. We were just talking before we got this going. I've actually seen this guy 5-6 years ago, and now I finally get him on the show. I'm joined by Simon Marcus. It's so crazy that we were finally able to put this together. But first and foremost, tell the people how they can get a hold of you.
You can get a hold of me on Facebook, Simon Bad Boy Marcus. Or you can get a hold of me on Twitter, Simon Marcus, N-O-1, Simon Marcus, #1, at twitter.com.
Okay. Well, before we get into it, I want to just start off with the most recent fights. And first of all, I'm going to be one of them to go ahead and say it. I was dead wrong. When I first watched you emerge, I was like, you know what? This guy's got all the tools because you had the firepower. You had the natural pop to score big KOs and have success in kickboxing. So when I heard you were moving over to do both, you know, because I'm assuming you're going to continue to do full rules Muay Thai and kickboxing. But when I first heard you were coming over, I was like, you've got all the tools. But when you came over, it still seemed like you would score, you know, big punches in moments, or you'd still rely on the clinch for most of your defense. And I'd always be like, you know, sometimes his shoulders get squared. Sometimes when he's going for the kill, he's not worried. He's not thinking about his defense. And I thought that there were going to be guys like, you know, Wayne Barrett and guys who can kind of like point fight you. They'd be able to score. And then, you know, when he got in the clinch, that's when, you know, the rest will come in and keep you from working as they usually do. But this time, when you came out for this tournament, you had this consistent game where you were able to score a single kick offense, whether it was a body kick, the low kicks, it was keeping your space, you had good step-up knees, and then you closed the distance with your hands, and you did so much better job of the defense, of kickboxing flow, and as soon as it happened, I was like, I was wrong. I was wrong about what was going to happen in this fight. Could you tell us a little bit about your transition from doing full rules Muay Thai to prepping yourself to be a kickboxer full-time, or, well, kickboxing as well?
Well, the thing about me is, in Muay Thai, I have a pretty strong clinch game. Everybody mm-hmm. knows that.
Yes.
And like you said, I use that for defensive purposes as well. So if I could get you in the clinch, it's going to take away most likely what's going to be a lot of my opponent's stronger weapons. So transitioning to kickboxing rules and kickboxing rule setting is just me more teaching myself not to always go into the clinch after a hit or two, or look for the clinch and close the distance, but try to fight from the outside more, try to use my hands a little more, setting it up and countering as well. And just not always going to the clinch, which is something I was used to during hitting you with a shot and then setting up a knee or an elbow right away, tiring you down or whatever the case might be. So that was the main transition for me. It was just not doing some of the things that I was just used to doing all the time.
For sure. Good stuff there. Well, let's go ahead and break down the tournament. What were you thinking going into the Wayne Barrett fight? Now, you don't have to necessarily go down detail by detail because there's a chance you could fight him again, you know. Just what were you feeling on that night? Did you feel anything particularly from him, you know, was there any opening that you felt in the moment where you're like, you know what? My single kicks are going to score. I'm quick enough. I'm fast enough to get away with my offense before he can get back.
Well, I just felt that going into the fight, I had more of an arsenal than he did. I can use all my weapons period. I could use all my weapons, and I felt Barrett wasn't as strong with, you know, he doesn't really use the knees and the kicks as much mm-hmm. as he does his hands, so I just felt that it was up to me to make sure I landed when I could, hit when I could, and not got carried away and just basically exchanged on his terms and didn't get overzealous, just trying to hurt him or make the fight a rough fight, but just took what was open, and that's what I did.
Did you feel the same way as you went into the final, the tournament final?
With Wilness, because I wasn't sure who I was going to fight, Pereira Wilness, I didn't think about it as much, but I just felt that Wilness is more of he's just a fighter that I could, I was better than. I just felt I was better than him, mm-hmm. and I would be able to use my skills to just beat him toe to toe.
For sure. And real quick, the judging on that one was horrible. I thought it was all three rounds clear for you. I was pretty surprised by that score.
Yeah, somebody gave him the fight, which was crazy. But, I mean, that's why you can't really ever trust the judge to leave it in the judge's hands. But at least it went my way, to say the least.
For sure. Well, let's go back to the beginning. You've said many times in different shows and so on that, you know, you had – you're getting into a little bit of trouble and you got introduced to, you know, Muay Thai, and it kind of gave you structure. It gave you something that you fell in love with and so on. And I told you before that Clifton Brown is where I first heard about you. That was the first person that told me who you were. And of course, the opportunities that you had in the MPL back in the days where you fought Vakadov, whatever. A lot of people don't know that. Both of you guys still, you know, fighting at an elite level on the scene, but you fought Vakadov twice and beaten him twice. And it's crazy. Could you tell us a little bit about the beginning of your career when you first got into it and your gym there in Toronto?
Well, I started Muay Thai just because I was always, from a little kid, in love with this fighting. I always liked to fight, and it started with wrestling. I used to watch like WWF wrestling, and I was just like a fanatic about it, and I would always want to wrestle with my friends and they wouldn't be having it, so I'd just be like forcing them to like give them suplexes on the mat in my bed. So I've always been into fighting, and I've always been very active and athletic. So I've done like every sport you can name. I've done it, and I wasn't very academic growing up. It didn't interest me very much. So the older I got, is like I just kept getting into this pattern of getting in trouble for either fighting or like playing too rough or hurting people, and it just kept going and going until I became a teen, and you know, the whole structure of school and what you're supposed to do, I wasn't really feeling it. So I ended up getting into like a crowd of people that wasn't really following the law and ended up getting in trouble. But after that, I just felt that that wasn't really for me. Like, you know, there was bigger things, there was better things, there was more things to strive for in life than just like, you know, breaking the law and doing things that are going to put me in places where I don't want to be. So with that, with those affirmations and like that, those realizations, I just thought I needed to focus on something. And at that point, I had already tried Muay Thai at the age of 16. I did it for maybe a month. I got kicked out of one school, ended up at another, and a friend told me about it, and his brother was like a really good fighter and was beating people up on the street and stuff. So I was like, yeah, let's go to that gym. Let's learn how to fight. I want to learn how to really fight. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it was so physical compared to any other sport I did. I was like, yo, this sport is gonna make me stronger than I've ever been, and it's going to teach me how to fight. So I was so enthusiastic about it. So after getting in trouble for a bit and stopped doing Muay Thai just because I didn't have the discipline to like be going to the gym and training every day, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. I wasn't like, well, I'm going to be this or I'm going to be that. But one thing I knew was like, I got to go back to the gym. I got to train. I got to learn this art. I got to get better. I got to get stronger. And at the same time, I knew that me doing so was going to give me, something constructive to do with my time and make me, more disciplined individual as a person, not just in the sport or not just in martial arts, but just teach me that discipline that I felt I needed at the time to like take up my time and stuff. So I did that, and basically I just fell in love with it from there. I was already in love with fighting, but when I went back to it, it was like I had my first fight not long after that, and just the challenge in the whole process, it was just like, that was it. You know, this is it. I'm going to be the best one day. And I just followed that, and the rest is history.
Crazy. So tell me a little bit about some of your early experiences in fighting. I know that there is, you fought on the IFMAs several times, the IFMAs. So tell us a little bit about some of that early career. I know I get mixed results when I talk about Canadian Muay Thai. Sometimes I'll hear people say, I had a decent amount of fights. Sometimes I'll hear people say, I didn't have that many opportunities. What was it like for you, whether it be amateur or pro, just total fights? Because really in Muay Thai, a lot of people don't realize this, it's just so much about experience and opportunity that most Muay Thai guys don't pay attention to getting paid every fight, every check, and so on. So a lot of times when people go fight in the IFMAs, they do it out of their own pocket. You know, they just do it out of their own money.
That was our scenario. The first time I went to the IFMAs, World Amateur Championships, was in 2007. And I started training in 2005, but I really only trained maybe like 3 or 4 months out of the year. So I'd been doing Muay Thai roughly a year. And within that year, I had about 6 fights going into the World Amateurs. So I competed in the World Amateurs in Thailand, 4 fights in 5 days, and I won a gold medal. I won every fight. We trained really hard for 3 months leading up to it. And yeah, it was awesome. And then I even fought more. I fought like two or three more times right after that in Chiang Mai, Thailand. So that was a point in my career where it was like, okay, I made the decision. This is what I'm doing. I had some success in my city, which led me to being picked for the amateur team and my coach picking me. And I was trained hard and dedicated to it. But I also needed, like you said, I needed the experience. So at that point in my career, I was like, I need to fight as much as I can, anywhere I can, and anybody I can to build my name and build my experience. So from basically 2007, 8, 9, 10, like even in 2010, skipping forward 3 years, I was fighting in Thailand professionally, but getting paid like $30 at, at MPK just to get a fight, just to, you know, I was going to Cambodia driving for like 8-9 hours in the back of a small car just so I could fight and build my name, my reputation, and get paid like $90 or $60. So it was just all about the experience. It was something that I did because I loved it and I wanted to climb the ladder, make my name known, and gain experience, which is very difficult to do. So you got to be willing to, like, it's like school. You got to be willing to pay your tuition and go to school for all those years to get the payback in the end with the job, which fortunately enough for me, it did pay off. But in Canada itself, I didn't really have much official amateur fights. There's no real sanctioned body where you could fight at the time. But I did have a couple ones, one or two in Vancouver, or one or two in Montreal, just small, more underground shows. But that was pretty much it. 2008, I went back to the World Amateurs. I got a silver in the A class, came up short in the tight decision in the finals, and that just made me strive to push harder and harder and harder. And then I finally went pro, and when I went pro, I was just on a winning streak for a long time.
Now, what are some of the names of the who you would say were the tougher guys that you went against when you were in IFMAs? Do you remember any of their names?
I don't really remember many of their names, but one guy I fought in the World Amateur Finals that I got a close decision loss to was Zainis Hanarok, and he was from Belarus, and he still fights to this day, heavyweight though. And the thing was, at the time I was fighting at 190 pounds, and everyone was cutting like 10, 15, 20 pounds. So I was like the smallest. Mm-hmm. And kind of similar to Glory. I'm one of the guys, a lot of people don't believe how big I am when they see me in person, but I'm one of the smaller guys in the weight class, but I don't cut much weight to make it to 187. And yeah, he was one of the tougher opponents I fought. I also fought Philip Verlinden that year in the semifinals, and he was a tough opponent, but I was able to beat him decisively. And there was a couple more guys, but it's difficult to remember their names
for sure, in particular because everybody's wearing headgear. Okay, so you said that you trained in Thailand and you gone to Cambodia for fights and so on. What gym did you train at? Because of course it's I didn't know if you guys had met before the MPL, but the MPL was the first time I seen you work with Bukau, where you guys kind of had at that, like, there was like a press conference day where they had open workouts and you guys were clinching and a whole bunch of pictures emerged and so on. And then I guess it showed that you had spent some time training there before the Dubai tournament, if I'm correct.
Right.
So did you train with him before?
Yeah, I trained with him in 2010. I went to Porpamuk, the gym where he was training out of at the time, and I spent 8 months there. So I felt at the time, like you said, I wasn't getting exposure, I wasn't getting the fights, I wasn't getting the experience in Canada. I'm like, I need to go to Thailand and I need to fight and train as much as I can. And at first I was going to go for a year, and then my coach said, nah, it's too long. And then I decided 8 months, so I went to Porpamuk because I heard at the time that it was like one of the toughest gyms in Thailand. It's rugged, it's in the middle of nowhere, there's nothing to do, all you do is train. I'm like, yeah, that's where I need to be. So I went there and I grinded it out. Me and Bokal became really good friends, and our relationship grew from there. I learned a lot from him in that time period. And the MPL was a year later, so when you saw us sparring, it was like something we used to do quite often at the time.
Okay, crazy. So how did you get introduced to Clifton Brown, who gave you the he, of course, was the CEO of MPL when it first came out, and he did a lot of finding the fighters because he'd been in the sport for so long. Also, right. He's a guy who went over to Thailand for a year here and there. He picked up the language and so on. How did you guys meet, and does he have a major role in your career?
Most definitely. I met Clifton Brown when I walked into Siam number one. He was the first world champion out of Siam number one, the gym that I currently fight out of. And when I first walked in the gym, he was the guy. So at the time, you know, I was watching him hit pads, fighting, do different stuff. So that's how we met. And then, like, as I progressed as an amateur fighter and started to show that I was serious and stuff, he started taking, you know, we became training partners, and I was able to learn a lot from him. Like day in, day out, we would clinch, we would train together, we would talk about Muay Thai, watch videos, I'd watch his fights and see how our style, how he used our style of fighting and what I could use from it. So I learned a ton off of Clifton, and for sure those things stick with me to this day. So that's how we met, and we had a great relationship then, back then, when he was still in the gym, and we were training every day. We were just like feeding off each other, just learning, and students of the game.
Crazy. So let's go to the fight that kind of introduced you to the world. Joe Schilling fight number one. My favorite thing about this fight is because it's probably the most back and forth that I've ever seen on Facebook between different sides. So after it happened, and in my book, it was what I would consider in Thailand a perfectly clean technique to cause the sweep that got him off. Like if that were to happen in a stadium in Thailand, nobody would say nothing. So when it happened and he went down and they called it a count, you had, you know, the California contingent saying that it was a legal throw and so on. And then I watched and then I looked on Facebook and everybody in Canada is like, perfectly legal or whatever. Yeah. Gets up, you score the big shots afterwards to get to score the KO, and then controversy ensued. What was that moment? Because that was like the world that follows Muay Thai, that was a fight that they paid attention to. And I'd say that was probably the fight that they had first paid attention to you the most, because Schilling had a little bit of a name at that time. What were your thoughts on that night and that event? Like, how was that in the ring for you? Did you feel like it was a legal sweep, or did you feel like you were completely within the rules? What was that night like for you?
That move is completely legal. Anybody who was saying that move was illegal, either they were just completely biased or they just don't understand the rules. And a lot of people, and some people actually did think it was a heel trip, which it wasn't. I planted my foot and threw him over my knee.
Yeah, perfectly legal.
It wasn't my heel that I used to trip him. And when he got hurt, and we're in the sport of combat. We're in a combat sport. You don't do things without the intention of hurting somebody or of gaining an advantage. So whatever happens in the ring, you have to take responsibility for it, whether you're on the defense or the offensive end. So with that happening, of course, I jumped on it and made best of the opportunity. But in the moment, it just felt good because there was so much build up. There was words back and forth. There was a lot of people tuning in and wanting to see what was going to happen. And all the money was on the line, so pride was at stake as well. So I just wanted to make sure I got the win, and that's exactly what I did. And I felt great after the fight. I wasn't really worried about what everybody was saying.
For sure. And then he banded up and he paid you, correct?
Yeah,
awesome. You know, that happened in boxing once. I remember Fernando Vargas, he bet Sugar Shane Mosley in their first fight. And when he lost, he paid up his bet. We go into the second fight. The second fight with him, he scores it down in the first round. And then I had known your clinch was strong before, but I think that the first thing that kind of let me know just how strong a grip you have is how you were able to dominate the rest of that second fight. What is your thoughts on just remembering that? Because there's still that buildup. There's that, you know, revenge factor. You go down early, but then you pull it back together and you win the next four rounds and take the fight. What was the second fight like for you, for Joe Schilling?
The second fight, it was proving I'm the better fighter because, you know, the first one, everyone tried to say I cheated and it was a fluke. He hit his head. It was a freak accident, this and that. So they were really questioning my ability of being better than Joe. So the second fight, I was out to prove the same thing, that I was the better fighter. And he hits me with a shot when I was a little bit off balance, or he finds a hole in my guard, knocks me down, flash knockdown. And I just stayed focused, stayed in the fight, and we fought it out. And I was able to dominate an area I was stronger than him. So I just kept doing what was winning me the fight. And, you know, I felt good after. I felt confident the first fight. I felt confident the second fight. And got the W as planned.
Okay. So then we go to the third fight. Third fight, most people feel like it was one of the fights of the year last year. Joe comes out. He's able to, you know, point score, move. He gets the first round. Round two, you have a moment where it's almost like you just bit down in your mouthpiece and said, I'm going to throw power shots until I get him. You score down in the second round. He's able to outpoint you in the third, and then you go into the extra round, and then something weird happens where a point is taken from you. And I do think that there was some grabbing and holding on both sides, but a point's taken from you, and then Joe lands the big shot. You recall that fight, like, is there something that you go, you know what, as I look back on it, I was just, you know, going for it after I lost the point, and I was just trying to throw, and I wasn't so conscious defensively? Or were you like, I thought that, you know, I was down at that period of time, I needed to come back? Or what was your thoughts in that third fight?
Well, I felt after the three rounds, I felt I had the fight. I knocked him down in the second. I agree that the first round was close, but I agree he took the first round because he hit me with a good shot at the end of the round. But I felt, even still in the third round, I felt I won that round. Mm-hmm. Either which way, it goes to an extra round. My nose was broken in the fight from the very first round, so I was fighting with a broken nose, and it was difficult for me to breathe. Unfortunately, I had a shitty mouth guard in, and breathing out my mouth and breathing hard was causing my mouth guard to fall out. So I didn't really like the way the ref the fight, because he could see that my nose is broken. He's closest to both of us, and it was clear that I wasn't spitting out the mouth guard intentionally, and it happened about three times, and he waited until we were fighting to say, next time you spit it out is going to be a point. You know, he waited until we were fighting, so I didn't even get a chance to tell him, look, my nose is broken, or whatever the case was. Any which way, my mouth guard comes out again, point gets taken off, and there's like 30 seconds left in the fight. I had no choice but to go for the knockout or the knockdown to make it an even fight. So that's what I went for. In doing so, I got caught. I got caught with my hand down, and I got caught coming in by Schilling and knocked out. But I don't regret anything, because that's the kind of fighter I am. If my back's against the wall, I'm gonna go out shooting. I'm gonna go out firing. I'm not gonna just go out letting time run down, or you know, accepting the loss. I'm gonna do everything in my power in that moment to try to win. And if that means I got knocked out in the process, then that was a mistake that I made there on my part. I should have knocked him out in the process, but at the same time, I don't regret going for it. I don't regret what I did. I was going for the win, and you know, it just didn't go my way.
That segues us perfectly into your experiences in China. In China, you've put on some of the most awesome KOs that I've seen, in terms of how you'll do a good job of, you'll blend the hands, the guard will come up, and you'll slide the knee underneath, and you'll score some big KOs to the body. There's also a tournament in which you had a guy drop you in the early in the second round of the tournament. The first round, you had a tough fight, but you scored a KO. In the second fight, of that tournament, you were down early, and then you battled back. Despite the fact that your guy was scoring on you a lot, you battled back, and you got the KO there. You got a KO loss out there. China seems to be a place that's given you a lot of pro opportunities, and you are making your brand as a fighter to see. Because whether people feel about, you know, your defense and how your kickboxing is coming along and so on, you are bringing the fight every single time. Tell me a little bit about that, those experiences out there in China. They're giving you an opportunity to fight as a pro, and they're giving you the opportunity to sell yourself as a brand, as a guy who, hey, I can't miss kickboxing and Muay Thai. I'm not just a guy who's going to clinch.
China's been great for me. I made my name back in 2010 when I fought in the Sport Accord. A lot of Chinese people and saw me fight on TV, and certain promoters saw me fight, and they were very interested in, you know, the style and the power and the aggression and the will I bring in the ring. So they asked me to come back, and when I came back, I scored a great knockout and broke the guy's ribs with a powerful knee, and that was kind of like stuck in people's memory. Since then, that tournament you're talking about wasn't really a tournament. I was fighting two guys back to back in one night, and I did that on two different occasions. So that kind of built my name to be like a super fighter in China, and my fan base just grew and grew and grew. And as a foreign fighter in China, I probably have the biggest, if not one of the biggest names and attractions as a fighter. So yeah, like everything just kind of worked as it is. I lost my last fight, but before that I was undefeated in China, and I just been beating all their best fighters, so people love to watch me fight in China. It's been good because, you know, it's somewhere I can always go and get work, regardless of what's going on in the international scene in kickboxing or Muay Thai.
That's awesome. I mean, it's awesome to hear. I didn't even realize that those were just, that wasn't even a tournament. Those were just two fights. Yeah. That's awesome.
Fight back to back.
So we're going to go into that. You kind of have, as you talked about, this heart to, I'm going to fight whoever, fight two guys in one night, all these things that kind of sell yourself. You had a moment where you ran into the opposite experience. I watched the fight with you and Chidi and Joe Guani, and I remember when I watched it, I thought that it was a clear decision in your favor. Even with the down that he had scored, I thought that it was a clear decision in your favor. When the cards come back, and they had a majority draw, if I remember correctly, they gave the mic to you, and you went off. Like, you went off. You're like, hey, thank the fans and so on, whatever. But you said, TD, you had some choice words. You were pretty upset in the moment. Could you take me back to that night? What about the events? Now, clearly, there were some antics. There was some holding. There was some him walking backwards and buying some time, whatever. Who can blame him? I mean, you're a tough guy. You wore on him in the clinch and so on. But as you recall that night, what kind of set you off? Was it the scoring in total? Was it the action in the fight? Was it the ref?
It was a couple things. First to start with was the referee, because, you know, I was trying to fight. I was there fighting my fight. I hit him in the groin a couple times with knees, but none were intentional. I made it clear it was unintentional. Okay, the ref warns me and takes a point off me for knees to the groin, which I felt more than two, which he warned me about, were not to the groin. They were on the waistline. So that already pissed me off, that Chitty's complaining about knees that weren't to the groin, and looking for a way out, looking for the ref to help him. Now, the thing that really bothered me was that when I was clinching Chidi, doing damage, hurting him, he would turn his back and stick his head through the ropes. Now, this is something he did at least 4, 5, 6, 7 times during the fight. At least 6 times during the fight, he would turn his back during the clinch and just get the ref to break it. Now, there's a point where the ref warned him about it, but after the ref warned him about it, he continued to do so, and he didn't have a point deducted. He didn't have any repercussion to him doing that, but when he falsely complains about me hitting him in the groin, a point gets taken away from me, which makes the fight end up being a draw. So just the whole situation, frustration with the ref, with the judging, and, well, the judges scored it correctly because the ref really screwed it up, and with Chidi and just the way he was fighting, looking for a way out, that's what set me off, and when I go in the ring, you know, we train and we fight and we put our hearts into this and we do so with honor. And I just felt like that wasn't, that's not the way you try to win, or that's not the way you try to get a victory by trying to get a score taken away from your opponent with acting. Or, and I didn't like the way the ref was so quick to take a point off me for something he gave me a warning about, but Chitty could do the same thing repeatedly, and he, it was cool with him. He just say fight, you know, it was just his way out. So that really pissed me off. But you know, we in the sport of Muay Thai and the sport of kickboxing, and you can't always control what happens outside the ring. You just gotta kind of make sure you handle business on your end. So that's what I learned from that experience.
Well, a fighter that you'll never get such actions from is Artem Levent. And you guys are getting ready to go at it again for the second time. First time was one of, I'd say it's my favorite performance of yours, is despite the fact that you've gotten KOs and you've gotten more exciting performances, you've got bigger, you know, the knee stoppages, big stoppages with your hands and so on. But the reason why I like the Artem Levent fight is because, again, it shows your clinch's ability to neutralize the savviest of styles. And when you're dealing with Artem Levent, we're talking about a guy who, he's got angles down, he plays with different stances, he can score in weird periods of time, he's got, you know, diverse strikes. And when you guys went at it for the first time in line fight, you were able to neutralize him with the clinch, you closed the distance, you pretty much, you know, wore on him. Whereas even when he did have space, he didn't have offense because you had worn on him so much through the clinch throughout the rounds. Now we go into a fight where you only get a few seconds to clinch, and you've been dealing with glory refs for a while. That few seconds is like half a second, you know? They don't really give you time to work. So, like, as you prepare, and again, you don't have to give game plan stuff and so on, but what's your mentality as you go into the next time where you guys go five rounds? It's going to be kickboxing. And then another thing, what inspired you to take this fight so short notice? Now, again, it's not short notice in terms of, like, you won a tournament, so it made the most sense that you were the number one contender or whatever. But really, you're getting a four-week camp, and you came off of a tournament. Are you injury-free? Like, what is your whole process as you go into this? And again, you don't have to give game plans, but normally people would expect someone to take some time off after a tournament.
Right. Well, the tournament spot was for the spot to fight Levent on that day in specific. Mm-hmm. If I was hurt or if I was injured, then I guess they would have postponed. I don't know what they would have done in that case since I won the tournament. But going through the tournament, leading up to the tournament, and even before the tournament, my focus has been on the belt, being the champion of glory, not just winning a couple fights and saying, hey, yeah, I've made the adjustment. So even after the second fight when I won the tournament, my focus didn't stop there. I was still looking forward to fighting Artem. And I got one or two bumps and bruises, but nothing that's going to stop me from training or stop me from fighting. Being a Muay Thai fighter, as I said, you have to take opportunities when they knock. You gotta be ready to go. So I fought with a broken leg one time. I fought when I couldn't support myself almost on a certain leg, or I fought with a lot of injuries. So there's nothing that I walked away with that would stop me from preparing for this fight. And with Artem, the first time we fought, yeah, we were in the clinch a lot, and I was able to dominate in that area. But something that people got to understand is not, like, I wasn't the only one who was looking to go in the clinch. Mm-hmm. And I was also hurting Artem from the outside as well, and he was looking to go to the clinch, as he does when he tries to stop your offense. I'm a fighter. I fight, doesn't matter where the fight is. So May 8th, when it comes, whether we're on the outside, whether we're punching, kicking, or whether we're close, we're going to be fighting. And I'm going to be fighting, and I'm going to be setting the pace. I'm going to be setting the tone of the fight. So, you know, it's one thing to say it, it's another to do it. So I just advise everyone to tune in, see what's going to happen, and then you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. Regardless of what he brings to the table, what he has, I'm going to be able to match it. I'm going to be able to overcome it and be the victor on that night.
Awesome stuff, Simon. So let's tell me a little bit about your gym. This is an opportunity. I want to go into some questions where you get to sell yourself and your team and your coaching staff and so on. First things first, tell us about the coach that you work with the most.
I work with John Suchard. He's out of Muay Thai gym. He's branded here in Canada called CM Number One. That's where I train, and that's where I've come up over the years. He is a world-renowned Muay Thai expert in the area of Muay Thai. He's taught me pretty much all the techniques that you see me use in the ring, how to kick, punch, knee, and elbow correctly. And we have one of the best gyms in the world, and we build a strong foundation. We focus on physical strength, power, speed, and endurance, and that's what's given me the foundation to grow my career as to where to the point it is now.
Tell us a little bit about your teammates. If someone's listening to my podcast and they're not too familiar with your gym, could you name some of the athletes that they could know or athletes that you guys have coming up that the world should know in future? Male, female fighters, your gym's produced good on both sides. Tell us a little bit about the fighters that are at your gym.
Of course, there's Matt Embry. Matt Embry is another great Muay Thai fighter. He's out in Thailand right now. He'll be fighting Sanchai, one of the best Muay Thai fighters in the world, if not the best Muay Thai fighter, and on May 2nd. He's done great things out of our gym, won multiple championships. Also, in the past, there was Clifton Brown. He's a retired fighter now, but he was training out of our gym and won multiple world titles. We got a whole bunch of young guys coming up, too many to mention. We just got to kind of see who's going to take it to that next level. But in our gym, there's always fighters coming up, and there's always guys who are hungry to make it, and they have a lot of, predecessors to take knowledge from and to follow their path. So you're always going to see good fighters coming out of our gym, so just keep your eyes open.
For sure. And then last question is, this is your opportunity to thank any sponsor and then, of course, give credit to anything that you feel motivates you, family, whatever, faith, whatever it is that makes Simon Marcus Simon Marcus. This is your opportunity to give them a shout-out. Who would that be and what would that be in your life?
For sure. First, I'm going to shout out InFight Style. They're one of the only sponsors that have really, offered to help me in a way that I feel is worth it to what I've put into the game, and they're sponsoring me right now. So when you see me come out in my suits and my shorts and my gear, that's InFight Style, and you can check them out on Facebook or on InFightStyle.com. Look out for my brand coming out right now as we speak. It's called Original Bad Boy. It's going to be some real sick gear. You can see, get some of my personal stuff and apparel out of there. So keep your eyes out for that. And as far as faith and things that motivate me and drive me, I want to thank God, because I feel God all gives us a gift and a passion. And God's given me a gift and a passion and a vision to actually follow my heart and walk this journey in kickboxing, Muay Thai, and being a fighter. And I came from a life where things could have been very different, and I could have been a different kind of warrior, and no one would have heard about me other than in a newspaper or something else. So I always give God thanks for that vision, just to see myself as something bigger. And I want to shout out my kids. I got two kids. My son Zion, he's 3 years old. And my daughter Zanaya, she's 1.5, a little more than 1.5, and they motivate me every day, and not just motivate me to provide for them, which they do, but also motivate me to set an example, not just for them, but for everybody, of following your dreams, being true to yourself, and walking the journey and the path that you want, that you see, that you envision, that you want for yourself. So I have to do that so they understand that that's what they have to do, and that's what daddy does. So big up to everybody, my whole family, everybody who supports me, all the followers, all the fans. I really appreciate it, and I can't say that enough.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Simon, and I'm glad to have you on, my man.
Thank you, brother. More than a pleasure.
So that was Simon Marcus, and thanks again for having him on. That was a definitely good interview. I'm going to go ahead and get into a lot of the results that happened over the last 7 days. I don't have everything because not all the video emerged. For example, Artur Kachinko got a KO victory over Jonathan Oliveira, but I wasn't able to find the video of it. There was one that was up in Chinese, and I was pressing play, but it wasn't working in my area, so I wasn't able to get you a fight-by-fight breakdown. But, for example, that fight took place in Kunlun, and Artur Kashinko got that victory, and he's now looking forward to fighting again. Actually, a few weeks later, for Kunlun again, and a card that they're doing in Slovakia. So it's crazy that the opportunities that he's getting still keeps him, as a consistent fighter, just like Enrico Kale, same thing. Like, these guys are getting the opportunities to fight high-level international guys on a regular basis. And though Glory is, still considered the biggest, they've got the biggest TV deals, they're on in America on a regular basis. Good stuff coming from K1, who I'm about to talk about in a second. Good stuff coming from Kunlun. There are other promotions out there in Fusion, given, these fighters the opportunities to make money, to make a living. And it's something that I'm going to do a state of the game kind of episode in a couple weeks here, so that I can give people a rundown of what's really happening in the kickboxing world. And just because Glory, who's actually having a really good year, isn't doing what you thought they'd be doing, or maybe there are some athletes that you wish were on their promotion on a regular basis, you look at the situation with Gokhan Saki and Tyrone Spong, you're like, oh, it's the sky's falling. Don't go thinking that that means that kickboxing is in bad shape, because there's a lot of things. GFC, there's a lot of opportunities for these guys. And even if you look at K1 6 years ago, were they, the signs were there, but they were still doing events. They weren't as healthy as kickboxing is now. But I'm going to break that up in a little bit, and I'll give you guys a really good layout of what kickboxing has become. But I'm going to go ahead and jump into some of the results. I was looking for them fervently, but the K1 Japan 55kg tournament results did not pop up, the fights didn't pop up except for a few, and I'll go ahead and break those down. The ones that I was able to get a hold of anyways. Kamaru Philip Minoru gets another victory, this time over Hiroya. It's so strange to me because Hiroya came out and, is one round stoppage, but Hiroya came out and did what he normally does. He tries to get his low kicks going. He's got a really good low kick whip, not in terms of like a big thudding chop, like sometimes you'll see a Robin Van Roosmalen get a really big, outside whip to his chop. Hiroya kind of shoots it like a tie, like it comes from his hips like a tie. It's kind of like straight to the target. Masato had a similar type of low kick where it didn't have a big wide whip. It just went straight to the target. And Hiroya got that going early. But I'm telling you, Kamara, who, as I mentioned before, I thought that when he fought Ku Fairtex, that Fairtex should have won the fight. But Kimura did get that late down. Like, he did get that down in the third, and that's what swayed the judges, because this guy can crack. And you saw it here again. He scores. He uses timing really well. All he did was kind of make his movements and wait for the opportunity to score big shots while Hiroya was, throwing the kicks. And then towards the end of the round, he finally scored it, and he built on it. He was able to score three downs in the last minute of the round, I want to say, and that got him the TKO victory. Hiroya's game, he kept getting back up, but Kamara just too much, just too much with his hands, with his power. And it's crazy because he's like probably the whitest looking Brazilian I've ever seen in my life, and he is based out in Japan, so he speaks the language, he grabs the mic, and he talks to, the crowd and so on, whatever. They're going to be using him for quite some time. I do like that the K1 brand has got this guy who's, don't have to spend a lot of money to bring him across the world to, to get him on a card, and he's in there competing and scoring downs against the best fighters in the world. Now, I don't think that he does the same to either the Arabe brothers, but I do think that he's still talented and a guy to have on your cards. Next fight I'm going to talk about is the other super fight, where Koya Arube gets a victory over Javier Hernandez. Javier Hernandez was already in what, I would consider one of the fights of the year with Hirotaka Arube. But this time, and again, wasn't able to get this full fight. Koya Arube, who's the more polished of the two, I'd say defensively he's more polished of the two. And he was able to get a decision over the Spaniard, who's it's so crazy that I remember once upon a time, me and Ryan Scalia, we were talking about Javier Hernandez as being one of the best fighters in the world at 60 kgs, and what were they going to do with him, and what weight class were they going to have for him, and what would his future be like. And the way K1 has worked itself out, the way that things have changed, the way that things had shifted in the kickboxing world, I look at what's happened with Koya Arube, and I look at Javier Hernandez, and I look at Hirotaka, and I'm thinking to myself, man, it's crazy that he's starting to get a little bit of a platform. Now, again, is a good, solid audience for this card. Not a huge audience, but a solid audience. And I think that that's what you want. You still have that aura of, I'm going to go to Japan and compete to be the best in the world. Even though there are a lot better fighters in the weight classes, the smaller weight classes for Japanese fighters, it's just crazy that it looked like everything was pretty much done after it. Showtime was bought in by Glory, who didn't put any emphasis on the 60 kg weight class at all. So I'm glad that Javier Hernandez found a home. I'm glad that he's an action fighter and really just a guy that you could pretty much watch this guy compete and get your money's worth every single time. But he just, Koyo Rube is the best in the world, 60 kgs in the kickboxing world, in terms of the platform that he is competing on, because K1 is still doing international or bringing in international talent, and Javier Hernandez is a good representation of that international talent. So hopefully more moving forward. There are a lot of good fighters out there that fight and campaign around that 60 kg weight class. So as we move forward, we'll get the opportunity to see more of those athletes. But we'll just start off with a good solid victory by Koya Arobe. Going to go ahead and break into the tournament. And I'm going to go through this tournament fast because, again, none of these fights emerged except for the last fight, which was only up for a day, and then the person had to take it down. The favorite going into this, I would say, and it's the reason why he fought at the top of the card, is Takeru. Okay, Takeru is T-A-K-E-R-U. This guy is a bit of a showman, sticks his tongue out all the time. Sometimes you might even want to call his antics, you know, unsportsmanlike because of how wild he can be. But as far as bringing the action, he is got good KO pop. He'll stay in the pocket. He'll walk guys down. He believes in his chin, so that gets him in these crazy exchanges. And he scored one of the craziest KOs, spinning back fist KOs, that you're ever going to see. And I'll get into that a little bit later. But first, let's just start off with what happened in the first series of fights. And it is as the script would have, you know, what they would have hoped for if you are in a Japanese fan base or whatever. Every Japanese fighter won in the elimination round of 8. Takeru won by KO over Alexandre Prilip. Shota Takiya gets a victory over Daniel Williams. It was extra round. The way I had it from a couple of different sources is it was a bad decision. It should not have gone to an extra round. Nobuchika Torado, who, if I'm remembering correctly, had the opportunity to fight on Glory. The only time Glory showed a fight that was in that 55 kg range, he gets another, you know, debated bad decision, if you will, over Rui Batello. And then we've got Tega, who got a victory over Safyan El Haji, Haji. And that one seemed to be more sound, but it went as the script would entail. Just like if you look at when the K1 Max first started off, there was a decent amount of Japanese representation in that tournament and throughout the tournaments, because really it's a brand for Japanese television. So you want your Japanese athletes to move forward. The Japanese fan base will embrace a foreign star if they fight perform in such a way. Peter Arts was embraced by the, you know, Japanese community. Eddie Sauer is another one. Like, the crowds will come out and support these guys. If you've got that history, they will come out and back you. But it's always to their benefit to have what they had with Masato, a guy who can be the best in the world from your country. That helps you greatly. And after 4 fights, only thing we have left for Japanese athletes, and that definitely works in favor of those who have this product on TV. Takeru gets another KO over Shota Takaya, and Tega gets a KO over Nobuchika Torado. That one was a little bit of a surprise. I would have picked Rado in that one, but definitely nice KO. Tega and Takeru meet for the final. This is the second time they've met in 6 months, I want to say, was the last time that they got together in that fight. Takeru threw a high kick and he put a spinning back fist behind it, and it is probably one of the cleanest KOs you're ever going to see. That KO was just beastly. It just landed right on the mark, and Tega was gone. This one, Tega had the grit, and he kept pushing forward. He made the distance, but he was dropped twice. Takeru, too much power. He is important for their brand if he can keep winning by KO and knocking people out. He's already comes in with the dyed hair and the weird hairstyle. He comes in with a action-packed style. If they want to keep building on these lower weight classes, they've now done a 60 kg tournament earlier this year. This is 55 kgs. They're going to do a 70 kg tournament. If they keep staying in that area and below, they've got something that the rest of the world in kickboxing don't have as consistently. Nobody's got a 55 kg tournament. No one does. So, in particular, not on TV. So they're doing a great job of giving these athletes the opportunities to compete. But the athletes have got to do it themselves. And Takeru, him coming out there and not just winning, but stopping guys, making you think these little guys got power, that's what's going to draw people to the weight class. So good stuff for the K1 brand, which is continuing to, they are pumping out consistent shows, and that's huge. You guys might not have noticed there was a slight glitch in there. We're going to go ahead, and I think I fixed it for the most part. My apologies. But all I wanted to finish on was just to say that the K1 brand, consistent shows, they're doing a good job. And I love that, you know, they brought in Hador because Hador's got that history. And, you know, you got some fans that want to see the old-timers who did such great work in the late 90s, early 2000s, the stars that came from around the world. They usually like to bring in a Who star, Arts, or, you know, a Fedor in this situation or whatever. That's always going to happen because they're trying to speak to a part of their fan base that really, it was culture for them to grow up and see these guys on TV. You know, if you ever wonder why Kyotaro is crying when he beats Peter Arts, he's crying because he grew up and watched that guy on TV, and then he grows up and beats that guy. That's going to be a weird moment. So there is something about a fan base that grew up and saw certain athletes and wanted to be them. And I think that K1, bringing back these old-timers, guys who fought in Pride and K1 back in the day, I've got no problem with them doing those kind of things for publicity. The most important thing, though, is what happened in the ring. And what happened in the ring was awesome action and a guy proving to be the best at 55 kgs in the international market. Again, more competition will come in, more names will challenge, but Takeru did a great job of selling himself and winning the title. Going to go ahead and move into, we will go in Fusion, because they had two cards that happened over the last couple days, and, in the last week or so, and in these cards, we had good results, some upsets, we had some stars represented highly, they've got a brand of guys who are starting to have consistent success, and those are names that you definitely want to pursue down the road, because they could be on your glory cards, they could be on your K1 cards. Going to go ahead and start off with, I won't do them all, but I'll do most of them. Going to go with the Spain card that they did a week ago. That was on the 18th. It was right before my last results show. Ricardo Costa is defeated by Mikel Garcia. Mikel Garcia, just the combination flow too much. Very, very talented. Costa was game just to go the rounds, but he just wasn't skilled enough. Mikel Garcia gets the victory for Spain. Nissa Mexen, I'll talk about this more when I get my verbal sparring partner, as I've heard it called before, and Rosie Hayward. We'll do a show on the women, but Nissa Mexen is the best in the world at 54 kgs, thanks to her win over Iman Barlow, and the rematch is set up for July. But until that day, she is out there competing. Even Naranjo has got a victory over Iman Barlow. It was a debated victory, one of the few fights I wasn't able to see, but she was able to get her combination full off, and Eva's legit. Like, she can fight. Like, she would be, if you were to say, Steven, who's the top, make a 8-woman tournament of 54 kg fighters, Eva's in it. She's very, very talented. But Anissa Mexen, too much with the movement, left hook too smooth, consistent kickboxing, combinations, her low kicks, her counter kick game. Anissa Mexen does a great job, moves forward in this one. Ilham Nagar, really got the low kicks going against Amantio Parshiv. And Amantio is a guy who was game and he had some moments, but there's just too much watching. And then in the end, the fight kind of got dirty and they were kind of holding. Ilham Nagar, despite what the, you know, being held on and the moments that they had where a lot of activity wasn't taking place, as soon as there was any kind of separation, he was mean with the low kicks. And Nagar, who's fought many guys on the international level, he's always going to kind of be in that same area of kickboxing. I don't never see him or ever see him being part of the elite, but he can still be a good prize fighter in kickboxing, and he was able to get a victory here. Rafael Landra gets what I would consider is the upset of the card, as he beat Maximo Suarez. And the thing about it was, I was surprised at how they called this fight. I was certain that they would not allow the clinch to go as much as they did, because Rafael Landra, he just locked on like a full tie, you know, tie clinch. I won't say full tie because it wasn't what you'd see in the stadiums at the highest level. But he did get, you know, both hands behind the neck. And Maximo Suarez didn't know how to fight the arms. He didn't know how to do the hips. All he did was drop his head and just get kneed until Rafael Landra got tired and was stopped by the ref. I thought for sure the ref was going to step in and break him up, in particular after watching Infusion just the other day where they broke up all the clinches. But they gave him a full clinch. Maximo Suarez, when they were at a distance, combination flow was on point. He probably got that distance maybe 45 to 50 seconds in the entire three-round fight. The most of the fight took place with the pace of Rafael Landa moving forward, getting in the full clinch, and locking Maximo Suarez. Maximo Suarez, you've got every kickboxing skill there is. 75 kgs too big. Get yourself back down to 70 kgs. That's got to be certain. And your kickboxing flow is what people want to see on TV. You are a good action kickboxer. But no, you do not have the clinch down. You're going to have to spend some time to get better there. And Rafael Landa, I'm curious what comes from him. You know, he's not going to be able to get that clinch and, you know, against everybody. So maybe he's going to have to fight full rules Muay Thai a little bit more. If he wants to be a kickboxer, fighting Glory, fighting K1, those guys are going to shut that down. So he's going to have to figure out how to kickbox. But this is a solid win for him, and he moves forward as a name of a guy to pay attention to. Andy Sauer gets a, I won't say debated because it was close. I'll say debated is fine, not a robbery. I thought Andy Sauer beat Johnny Risco, and I thought Johnny Risco did a good job of keeping it close, looking for opportunities to fire back. But Andy Sauer, I'm telling you, by the end of the third round, I thought that he got his full a little bit, and I thought that in rounds two and three, he outdistanced Risco. Andy Sauer's slow start definitely worked against him because I could see them going in favor of Johnny Risco. But when they went to the draw, again, I had Andy a little bit ahead. But whenever Johnny Risco threw anything, the crowd went nuts. And that can have an effect. We call it the Masato effect here in kickboxing, because what Masato did, even when Masato missed, sometimes Masato would just look to throw angry and just throw, you know, something concrete, and the crowd would just go nuts, even though he was like getting destroyed by Bukau or something like that. That has been known as the Masato effect ever since then. This is a perfect example of the Masato effect in a fight where Andy Sauer got going in the fourth, but Johnny would just have these moments where he would just throw combinations, he'd just have some scores. He was physically tired, he'd be moving weird, and he kept pushing the pace. But I do think Johnny Risco was still scoring. I had Andy Sauer winning the fight. When they went to the cards, they gave the fight to Johnny Risco. Not the end of the world. I do think that this is kind of it's happened to Andy Sauer before. Last year, he and other, you know, a couple of them, where guys beat him, and you're like, you're Andy Sauer, you shouldn't be losing to this level of competition. Andy's been fighting so much, it makes sense to me that he's going to drop a fight here and there, and it makes sense to me that the guy can still upset him because of his slow starts and the fact that he fights in three rounders. But this was a good fight, good showing by Johnny Risco, and, you know, I don't think that he's going to be an elite name, but he could be up for consideration. Muhammad Bukhari, or Big Mo as they call him, gets a KO victory over Moises Buitai. And this is just an area of you gotta watch how your defense is, all right? Because it's weird, because it's like the moment that, you know, Moises Buitai did a good job of getting away from one of Bukhari's strikes. And then instead of like stepping away full with his defense, he just kind of leans. And while Bukhari is still in the pocket, Big Mo just unleashes a big left hook, and that's the end of your night. Moises got caught it clean, and he was done. And it just shows where it's like you did half of it. You got away from the first strike, but he just was lazy about getting his defense back up. He didn't get his feet moving too. You know, you want to get away, get all the way away. You know, don't just miss a shot and not look to counter. You got to miss and go. That's a lesson to every fighter out there. If you're going to play a game where you make people miss small, you got to throw something back. You can't miss small and then hang out to miss small again. It just doesn't work that way. Or make them miss small and be lazy like we saw here with Moises. If you make them miss small, you got to be in position to go. And he got the first evasion, and he still remained in a position where Big Mo could find him, and Big Mo found him. And that's the game. So I thought the Spain card was good. I thought the crowd was really into the fights. I thought they did a good job of carrying the pace and making the crowd kind of really love the action. I'm going to go from that card over to the card that they just had this past weekend in Slovakia, who, as I mentioned before, they're doing a lot of good kickboxing events, and they use a lot of their hometown stars in the card. Going to go ahead and start up. I will start with the tournament. Tournament had first fight on the card was, and after extra round decision, Milan Pales gets a victory over Brahim Benamar. I wasn't able to watch this fight because, and they'll tell you, for those who were watching it live, the Infusion stream was having some troubles in the beginning. So this whole fight in the extra round, I wasn't able to see. But fortunately for me, the fight came into play just in time for me to see Tigran Movsisian, as he fought Muhammad Jiraiya. This kid is the guy who I've been talking about for a while. I first found him in the Infusion Rookie Show, where he got a KO victory when he was 17 years old. He'd already had a good, healthy streak before that. But that was the fight that kind of opened up my eyes and say, okay, I want to watch this guy. There is a system of pad holding that's kind of been developed. I definitely want to credit Lucien Corbin as one of the guys who really got it going. But where they do these long combination flows, and it's just there's like knees and there's, you know, a lot of punch combination flows in it, and they're long combinations. I'm telling you, like 8 to 12, that's how long the strikes are in these combinations. They're starting to become a generation of guys that literally fight like they're doing those kind of combinations. Ilias Belal is one. Muhammad Jiraiya is the other one. Muhammad Jiraiya is just all action. He'll sit in the pocket, throw good hands to the body. He's got these strange angles on his step-up knees, his jumping knees out of nowhere. He's put flashes in there. Every once in a while, he gets a little reckless, but it's still fun reckless. And he threw heat, and he put on a performance, and he won the first round. He does a good job of being defensive when he focuses on it. You know, he's got a good guard, and he looks for counters well. He's got opportunities where he looks for good overhands and good wide hooks. It's just, sometimes it gets a little wild. And I thought that this fight he was cleaner. The second fight he wasn't as clean. Because when he met Milan Paulus in the final, clearly he was a better fighter. And the only chance Milan Paulus had in the fight was to really, really score in the moments that Muhammad Jiraiya was all over the place. And he caught him a couple of times, but not enough. Jiraiya was just too strong, was able to continue to score combinations throughout, sit on his shots, and the knees to the body just slowed Milan. He was game. He did a good job of representing Slovakia well, but the better fighter was Muhammad Jiraiya, who's going to go on to be one of the bigger stars in kickboxing. He's fighting at 70 kgs now. Now he just needs the opportunity. Someone's got to bring this kid in. Someone's got to do it. K1's got to do it. Glory's got to do it. Give him the platform to fight on the biggest stage. He's doing a great job with his platform now, and they're doing a good job of giving him fights that grooms him to get ready to fight the elite. He's going to have to get stronger because he's still a young guy, 19 years old. But, man, he's really, really putting on a show. If this was the old K1, he'd probably already be in the max. No question about it. Because Max loved that. They won at 19, 20, 21 years old because a lot of their fan base was female. They had young girls who were in high school and college age, and they loved them some Masato. And they wanted to bring people in. Artur Kashenko, why do you think he got signed 19, 20 years old? There was a look they were looking for. What is it? Albert Krauss was 21, I want to say, when he won the first ever K-1 World Grand Prix. They went young there. Muhammad Jiraiya and that generation would have already been signed. This generation, he's still got the skill set, and he's getting time to groom and get stronger, which is very important. Lucia Krajovic won an awesome fight with Marina Zueva. This one went to an extra because Marina Zueva's late push in the third round. I thought Lucia Krajovic couldn't miss a right hand. She scored every possible way you could score a right hand. She threw it straight. She followed it behind a 1-2. She threw a switch stance hook with her right hand. She threw a switch kick where she kicked and then she would throw the right hand on the way back. She scored a Superman. Every way you can score a right hand, Lucia Krajovic scored a right hand in the first two rounds of this fight. But the first round was definitely close because no one really kind of dictated it, and I thought Lucia Krajkovic won the last two rounds, but Marina Zueva in the middle of the third round had this moment where she just beasted down, and she was all over Lucia, and she looked like she had Lucia hurt, and Lucia definitely, took a knee in the clinch and was slowed for a moment, but then in the last 30 seconds, I thought Lucia let her hands go and made her mark on that last part of the round. When it went to an extra, I was fine with it because, I thought the fight was close. There, Lucia Krajovic turned it on. Kept scoring with combinations, kept scoring with her switch kick. She kept getting out. Lucia isn't the best athlete. She's a solid athlete, but she's not the best athlete. And she'll always struggle with the likes of a Mexen or a Iman Barlow because they're better athletes. But, man, she put on a good show. And even a fight with Denise Kielholz, she couldn't do anything with Denise for two rounds. In the third round, she figured it out. She's got the ability to fight elite level, and she's a name that I would consider if we were doing 54 kg tournaments. She'd be one of those on the fringe of 8-7. But she had a good win here, and it was a very entertaining fight. Vladimir Muravchuk is a consistent fighter who's been fighting in Slovakia for a long time. They put events based on him. He's gone over to I-1 and fought in China. He's fought in Thailand. This guy is one of the heroes, I would say, of Slovakia kickboxing and Muay Thai. He takes on Johan Ladon and full rules Muay Thai. For two rounds, I was like, Johan Ladon is just going to smash this guy. Like he was scoring low kicks. He was clean. He caused a cut early in the fight. I was joking on Twitter that there's no way they're going to stop this fight after one round with the hometown Vladimir Muravchuk. And to his corner's credit, that blood didn't get into his eye much. He kept pushing. But two rounds was all Johan Ladon. Too slick, savvy with the elbows, savvy with the movement and his kicks. And then rounds 3 through 5 happened, and Vladimir Muravchuk was all over him. He continued to score consistently. He started unleashing a mean body kick and head kick that just kept Ladon shelled up. He was winning the clinch moments. He's pushing the pace. And then Ladon, it just seemed like the wind just went out of him all of a sudden. Vladimir Muravchuk wins a unanimous decision after 5 at 75 kgs. I just thought that was a good push by him, and the crowd went crazy because of course, he's their guy. Last fight in the card we're going to talk about, and they gave the title shot again to Thomas, I think it's pronounced Sinker, as he went against Ibrahim El Bustadi, who's the undefeated Infusion champion, and I'm telling you, it's just... El Bustadi moves so weird. Like, you can't teach that kind of that movement, the way he throws his teeps. He plays a distance game, and then when he's in the pocket, he's in the pocket. And he's such a hard guy to get the rhythm of. And he caught Tomas at the very end of the second round. They were in an exchange, and he slid a knee in, and that knee landed clean to the body while Tomas was throwing a strike. And he went down, and that was it. It was the thing that you knew the moment that he got scored on, he wasn't getting back up. Just took the life out of him. El Bustadi, another one of these champions. We talked about Big Mo before. We talked about Muhammad Uriah. There is a contingent of Moroccan stars that are really doing good stuff. I wouldn't mind seeing El Bustadi fight the best in the world. 85 kgs. I wouldn't mind him, you know, going against Simon Marcus, who I had on the show. Wouldn't mind him going against, Artem Levan. I want to see him go against that level of guy. And now you're talking about the top of the top with those names. But if they do an 8-man tournament, get him in there. You know, let's see how he does with Willness. You know, I want to see him get those opportunities. Good stuff here. Good stuff by Infusion. And good stuff by kickboxing in the last couple weeks. So I'll be back with more kickboxing action. There were some stadium things that I was trying to get to, but the fights didn't emerge. So I'll do my best to, you know, get the Kongsak and Petr Bunju fight. I'll try to talk about them in future. I just didn't get the opportunity to get them on the show. So thanks, everybody, for listening and following. Thank you again, Simon Marcus, for doing the show. And everybody, continue to follow the Kickboxing Podcast show. I'll do my best to get you guys that action, full rules Muay Thai. I've been failing in that area because I've been busy with work. But I'll make sure that I hit that up real strong moving forward. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for following Kickboxing. And thanks for following me, Stephen the Warman, on Twitter. Peace.